Okay, so this morning we come to mind, third tetrad, citta upasana. I've put some charts up, not so that you can mentally and busily distract yourself, but more just as prompts. If you're forgetting where you're supposed to be going in a stage, just look on the charts. And just to do with key factors of mindfulness, the factors, dhyana factors, or five factors of observation and other things. So we come to citta upasana, contemplation of the mind. And in a way, it's one, this is a stage we've really needed to get to. Because one of the things you will have observed over these first few days of the retreat is that the mind's there all the time. And at various times the mind's quite dominant in terms of one's experience. So we need to know how to deal with mind in terms of the practice. And once we've dealt with body, feeling and mind, we've dealt with basically the whole of our experience in a broad sense. So mind, a good definition of mind is heart, mind, seat of thought. The centre of mind is here in Buddhism, centre of the heart. And when one visualises, for example, one visualises from here. So the Pali English Dictionary, page 266. The centre and focus of man's emotional nature, as well as that intellectual element which inheres and accompanies thought. Best understood when explained by expressions familiar to us. With all my heart, I have no heart for it. All of which emphasise the emotional and cognitive side of thought more than its mental and rational side, for which we have manas and vijnana. It may therefore be rendered by intention, impulse, design, disposition, state of mind, reaction to impressions. So, the centre and focus of man's emotional nature, as well as that intellectual element which inheres and accompanies thought. So the mind. So, where to begin with the mind? So, in stage 9 of the practice, the Buddha recommends sensitive to mind, I breathe in, and sensitive to mind, I breathe out. And here we begin to apply Dhamma Vichaya, investigation of mental states, which is that by which we sort out our mental states into the skillful, which we need to cultivate, and the unskillful, which we need to transform. So Dhamma Vichaya, the investigation of mental states, it's a real skill for which we need a positive humility when approaching Anapanasati. So by positive humility is, if we're looking at our mind in terms of dividing into the skillful and unskillful, or seeing the skillful and unskillful, we need to have a very clear and transparent honesty about the unskillful. You know, we need to be seeing what is, not who we think we are. And again, you know, we're coming back to clear observation of what is. And if you spend enough time in meditation, I mean, your mind will think of everything eventually. From, you know, the most perverse to probably the most exalted. That's the nature of the mind. It'll come up with everything. So it's just a question of looking at the mind, mental process, and beginning to see actually what's going on. And in this stage, we begin to develop awareness of the processes of the mind, acknowledging the contents of the mind as fully as possible within an ethical context. Basically within the context of metta of the precepts. So we're acknowledging the contents of the mind as fully as possible. And if we really start looking at the mind, some of it may not be very comfortable because it won't actually coincide with our view of ourselves as we are. But that doesn't matter. We just look at the mind as it is. So at the beginning, reactive mental processes are generally dominated by raga, lust or greed, dosa, anger or hatred, and moha, delusion, confusion, bewilderment. So there's essentially two processes to the mind. There's the cyclic reactive and there's the creative augmentative. So really what we're looking out for is either cyclic reactive process or creative augmentative process. So the important point being to recognise and distinguish between the mundane, cyclic, unskillful condition process and the augmentative, spiral, creative mental process. So in principle, we need to be able to distinguish between the hindrances and the path and principle. So we could see the creative spiral process in terms of the five spiritual faculties, or we could see the positive factors have developed limbs of the Noble Eightfold Path, the six paramitas, the 12-fold spiral path, seven factors of enlightenment. But the important thing being to recognise and distinguish between cycling and augmentative spiral creative mental process. So we begin with good old lust and greed, raga. And then there's dosa, which is anger and hatred. And raga is the tendency to attract, pull in towards oneself or grasp onto. So if you want to know if it's lust, if you just imagine, just have a sort of visual image of a hand. If you're trying to pull something in towards yourself, if you're trying to grab onto something, it's lust and greed. And dosa is anger or hatred. So if you're trying to push something away, if you're trying to push something away from yourself, then it's anger and hatred, and it's the tendency to repel, repulse, push away. And then there's moha, which is delusion, confusion, bewilderment. So delusion has a tendency to circle around on itself. So if you're not sure, quite often with delusion, you're not sure. You're not sure what it is. But if you look at it, it just keeps coming around again and again and again. That's delusion. So samatha, the calming processes, tend to work with greed and hatred. While vipassana, the more insight type practices, tend to work with delusion. And delusion is the underlying view that sustains greed and hatred. So delusion is where we experience an underlying belief or tendency that something in the world can ultimately satisfy us. But it's more than this. Delusion is the belief that we can get more from something than it can give us. Delusion is the culpable refusal to see beyond our projected gratification to the real nature of a given situation. So delusion is a culpable refusal. And if you look at delusion in yourself, you'll see that culpability aspect. You know all the theory, you know why it's not good for you and all the rest of it, but you still want to grab onto it, or you still want that thing, whether it's to hate someone or whether it's to actually pull someone into yourself. So it's a culpable refusal to see beyond our projected gratification. So we project the gratification onto an object of perception in some way. And that projected gratification is that it's going to sort out our situation in some way. It's either by destroying that thing or that person, or by taking possession of that thing or person, and that will sort the situation out. So culpable refusal to see beyond our projected gratification to the real nature of a given situation. So this is the first thing. When we look at mind, sensitive to mind, we just look at our mental states. And basically, are they skillful or unskillful? I mean, you don't have to go into all this detail. You can just say, oh, well, that one's skillful, that one's unskillful. If you've got some sort of ethical sensibility and feel for metta, it's not that difficult. And at this stage, you're not trying to do anything with them. You're just seeing what's going on. We're just being sensitive to the mind. And again, we're just anchored to the breath. So we're just lightly anchored to the breath, observing the functioning of the mind. And also be aware that mind is a process rather than a thing. You know, in the same way that the breath is a series of processes, so is the mind. So we begin to develop awareness of the processes of the mind with a warm, kindly awareness, distinguishing between skillful and unskillful mental states while remaining mindful and aware of the breath. You know, we can notice if the mind is expanded or contracted, distracted or undistracted, or whether a mental state's normal or exalted. One of the sort of symbols I use for my mind, coming from the South Pacific, is the sea. You know, on any day that you turn up to the sea, it's going to be a sort of climate. Yeah, the sea could be sort of whipped up and with choppy waves and sort of turbulent and dark, or the sea can be tranquil, bright, sunny, clear. Yeah, the sea can be brooding. The sea can be bright and sunny but still agitated from a wind. So there's all sorts of different moods and climates to the sea. And in a way, we're trying to look at our mind about the same way. It's like when you go to get dressed in the morning, you know, I mean, normally, you know, you stick your nose out the window and see what's going on. And then you go to your wardrobe and you dress, but you don't go through some convoluted intellectual process analysing, you know, what you're going to wear, and, you know, what type of clothes they are, and what the clothes are made of, and so on and so forth. You know, you just look out the window, see what the weather's doing, and go and dress. And if you're not sure, you might open the door just to see, you know, how cold it is. And then you dress accordingly, and you don't really think about it. It's just how it is. So we're looking at the sort of climate of the mind. The mind always has a climate. And at this stage, yeah, just to re-emphasise, we're just watching what happens. It's observation. You can't overstate the importance of just observing, of actually seeing what's going on. You know, the Buddha's teaching is immediate and visible all round. And if you read the canon, you know, the Sutta Pitaka of the Pali Canon, which is really the main historical record we have of the Buddha, he's always pointing to things around him when he's illustrating points to do with his teaching. You know, do you see this? Do you see that? Can you not see this? It's like, you know, the turner's apprentice. It's like the farmer ploughing the field. It's like this, it's like that. So we're looking, we're observing. So the point is not to look at mental states judgmentally. You know, especially give yourself a good whipping for your perceived unskillful mental states. Well, you know, you can relax, because the good news is, you know, the mind's utterly depraved and perverse at one end of the spectrum, so it's going to think of absolutely everything. So there's no point in whipping yourself for it. It's just the way it is, and the guy sitting next to you is probably even worse, so don't worry about it. I sometimes think if we could invent a machine that, you know, you could stick on the side of someone's head and their whole sort of mental, emotional processes would be on a screen on the wall. It would just save us so much chit-chat and dharma, you know. because we could just go around here, everyone could just put it on the side of the head for 5 minutes, and that would be that. You know, we just go to the throne room and get on with it. Because I think you'd find that actually we're not that much different. Slight, you know, maybe there's a bit more emphasis on particular colours of the rainbow here, and, you know, emphasis on the other colours of the rainbow there, but I think it's pretty much all the same. So we're beginning to unhook from mental proliferation. So we just note and experience mental states within an ethical context. And, you know, what is. It's a vipaka. You know, it only becomes a problem sometimes if you go out and start acting on it. So long as it's just rummaging around your mind. I mean, if it's homicidal, well, you know, it's homicidal. You know, it's okay. So we begin to unhook from mental proliferation, and we begin to unhook from the story we're telling ourselves, and get back to a bare awareness of underlying mental states. So the practice starts expanding out here, because we're starting to move into mind, we're starting to deal with consciousness, we're starting to deal with volition. So, you know, we've established a base of awareness of the body with the breath, positive vedana, positive feeling with the breath, and now we're beginning to look at the mind. But the mind is a much more complex beastie. It involves all sorts of things. And also, just to flag this up, I'm not going to go into much detail here, but we'll start to become aware of consciousness and the processes of the mind. And that's another thing altogether. You know, the relationship between the processes of the mind and consciousness is something that we begin to see more of as we move into the Dharma Tetrad and beyond. You know, consciousness is an omnipresent mental state. In a way, you could say that experience is self-cognizant. Yeah, consciousness is just a fact of things. It's self-luminous in a way. We don't need another consciousness to see that consciousness is conscious. In the same way that we don't need to turn another light on in a room at night to see that this light is on. The consciousness is just cognizant. And then there's also the mental processes. So we're looking at the mental processes in just a straightforward way, and you know, essentially whether they're skillful or unskillful. So we begin with raga, lust or greed, dosa, anger or hatred, or moha, delusion, confusion, bewilderment. But it also may be that when you look at the mind, that it's actually quite positive, you know, allowing for the fact that we've just come through vedana. So the mind may be saturated with sukha. So, you know, you would be aware of the fact that there are skillful enlightenment factors present. And in the system of Anapanasati, we deal with the 7 factors of enlightenment. So, you don't need to know all the detail of the different states. That will come with time. You know, mindfulness, investigation of mental states, joy, concentration, you know, equanimity, the rest of them. But immediately, yeah, it's okay if you're experiencing positive, you know, enlightenment factors or positive dhyana factors. You're just aware of that. You don't need to be any more or less aware. And just sit there and enjoy them. You don't have to sort of generate unskillful mental events because you're being sensitive to mind. As I've mentioned earlier, you know, if you're experiencing positive mental events, in a way you can just drop the whole system. And just sit there and be with the mental events, the positive, skillful mental events. And this does happen as you progress in the spiritual life. You know, you just will begin to experience positive mental events, and you're quite happy sitting there just enjoying your positive mental events because they're positive and you can do it. And it's good fun, so you just do that. I mean, you could argue that, in a way, the spiritual life doesn't begin until the development of positive spiritual faculties. And the Buddha is certainly implying this with the Anapanasati meditation practice. It's a movement into deeper and deeper states of joy, happiness, tranquility, insight, equanimity, appreciative awareness, all these things. But unfortunately, that's not where most of us are at. You know, that's why we become Buddhists. Because, you know, we basically get fed up with our experience of the continuous experience, continuous and unrelieved experience of the hindrances in one form or another. And certainly, within the context of meditating on this retreat, you know, the mind is going to become prominent in our experience at different times, and it's probably not going to be that comfortable. So with stage 9, you know, we begin to deal with it. We become sensitive to the mind. We become aware of the skillful and the unskillful, beginning with raga, dosa, moha, lust, greed, anger, hatred, delusion, confusion, bewilderment, and or, you know, positive enlightenment factors. And just to reiterate, we're not trying to judgmentally look at mental states. We're looking at the mental states as a warm and kindly awareness, but distinguishing quite honestly, you know, with a positive humility between the skillful and the unskillful. So has anyone got any questions at this point? Good. So moving right along, stage 10 is gladdening the mind. It's quite an unusual English word. It's a bit old fashioned, really, gladdening. But if you start trying to think about another word, it's very difficult to find one. So the idea here is to make the mind joyful, contented, bright and uplifted. And it works on the very simple theory that what you place attention upon, that causes to grow, to become, to flourish. So traditionally, one recollects the Buddha, one's teachers, spiritual progress already made, and the precious opportunity to practice Dharma. This precious human rebirth. So, but a good place to start with all this, you know, sometimes when we're dealing with this, the Buddha might be a bit abstract, or you may not feel in touch with your teachers or whatever, but it's good sometimes to actually work in a way that's accessible to us. So a good place to start, even on a mundane level, is with gratitude. So gratitude for limb, life, education, rule of law, leisure and opportunity to practice Dharma without fear or prosecution. And we also have plenty of food, clean drinking water in abundance, medical care, friends and family. And one story I tell, if you, quite a few people here have heard it before, but they can just nod off for a few minutes while I repeat myself. I'm a carpenter by trade and have run building businesses for quite a long time, and one of the things of being a builder in the movement is you get to go to all the women's retreat centres. And because you're doing building work, you normally have a place to yourself, so you can sit around, read all the books in the library, wander around the kitchen and the rest of it. And I was up doing some work at Te Ratnaloka in Wales, and I used to go for walks in the evening, and there's this big reservoir up there. It's a great big reservoir. It's probably, you know, a good 100 hectares. It's quite big. And there were some books in the library about the history of this reservoir. And so I started reading up on it. And at the time, in the late 19th century, there was the city of Powys, which is, you know, I don't know, 20, 25 miles from this reservoir. The citizens of Powys, there's about 1,500 or 1,700 a year dying from the drinking water. They were contracting cholera and dying from the water they were drinking. So, you know, that was the state of England at the time. You know, the water you were drinking, you couldn't even guarantee it wouldn't kill you. And so they decided to build this dam, this reservoir, and then it goes into how they constructed the dam and all that, which sort of being a geeky building type, I was really fascinated by it, but I won't bore you with the details of that. But anyway, they built this dam, this great reservoir, and then they piped water to Powys, and on each street, each corner of each block of houses in Powys, there was a tap stand, and you'd get water that you could drink that wouldn't kill you. And that was a miracle. You know, that was a transformation of life for people. You know, it affected infant mortality, you know, adult mortality, all sorts of things. Well, now, you know, we just take it completely for granted. I mean, I can go anywhere in Europe and drink tap water and guarantee it won't kill me. In fact, I can wash my damn car and it doesn't really matter. Yeah, you know, we do all sorts of things with it. You know, we flush it down the loo. So you've got all this drinking water, and we just squander it everywhere. You know, and almost oblivious to the fact that, you know, this is the case. And this is only one thing, you know. Reading a history of Western surgery, the thing that used to kill most people before the 20th century was septicemia from teeth, toothache. That was the thing that used to kill. And there was very little chance of getting to 50 or 60, you know, like very Charlene and I sitting there, you know, we're probably a big goiter on the neck or something, or, you know, one of your legs, you've had that chopped off because the cartilages don't work. You know, those sorts of things. And there's so much that we just have that we take for granted. We have leisure, you know, we have comfort, we have warmth in the winter. You know, coming from the South Pacific, I mean, you know, it's just really cold up in the Northern Hemisphere. And go up to Sweden and Finland, you know, it's like seriously cold. I remember talking to a Finn once, because things in Finland work, and they work well. And I was saying, why does everything work in Finland? And he thinks about it, he says, in Finland, you take the cold seriously or you die. there's so much, you know, we have to be grateful for, and the opportunity to practice Dharma. Last night, for some reason, I had this dream all night about the ISIS. I was in Syria, and I won't go into all the details. I wasn't fighting with them. we can do our retreats here. We don't have to worry about, you know, a gang coming in and just like ransacking Padmalaka, killing half of us and shooing the rest of us away. You know, we have rule of law. And we have order. You know, if we ring up the cops, there's a pretty good chance they're going to come out and give us a reasonable deal without us having to give them a bung. So we've got so much to be grateful for, and just leisure time. And it's not to say our lives are necessarily easy, but you know, we have a lot to be grateful for. So gratitude is a good place to start, even on a mundane level. And without rule of law, without enough food to eat, without leisure and opportunity to practice Dharma, without fear of persecution, it's not possible to practice Dharma. So in terms of gladdening the mind, we can just reflect on, you know, how fortunate we are and the opportunity we have. And then it's not such a big step to reflect on the Buddha. It's quite extraordinary that you know, we have access to the Buddha's teaching. If you consider, you know, you consider the span of history and time and civilizations, you know, we have access to the teaching of a Buddha. That in itself is quite remarkable. And then also one's teachers. You know, everybody who's actually, you know, helped you get to this position that you're in now. Just a simple gratitude. I mean, they don't have to do it. I mean, Sangha actually didn't have to come back from India. I think he probably would have been a lot happier, actually, just sitting in a monastery somewhere up in Ladakh or somewhere, just, you know, reading his sutras and doing his meditation and living with, you know, seven or eight other monks. Subuti didn't have to put himself through all the bother and trouble of being the sort of architect and lawyer of the movement, and the amount of flack he's copped. Could have gone and done other things. You know, I mean, there's lots of people, made this opportunity possible. Even down to the previous retreat, people cleaning up and tidying up and just keeping Pamela going and stuff. So, one's teachers, all those have helped one on the path. And in a way, it's a simple human, simple human emotion, to be gratitude, grateful to one's parents, to one's friends, to one's teachers. It's just a simple, basic human emotion. Human society works on the numberless kindnesses that we perform one to another each day. That's what keeps it all going. So it's just basic positive emotion, a healthy human disposition towards one's friends and teachers. And then spiritual progress already made. And this can be a bit of a difficult one sometimes, especially if you've had, a day and a half of nothing happening in your meditation and you've got sore legs. You can feel like, well, there's not much spiritual progress being made at all. But if you reflect on where you were, say, 20 or 30 years ago, where you are now, there's been quite a lot of progress. And obviously the precious opportunity to practice Dharma and this precious human rebirth. And, I think in the West sometimes, we're almost so spoiled, we're so mollycoddled politically and socially that we lose sight of the precious opportunity of this human rebirth. It's not going to go on forever, it will come to an end. And it may come to an end before we die, the political process is by no means guaranteed. And our lifespan is certainly not guaranteed. The one thing we know for sure is we're going to die. And it sneaks up on you fast, like up to about 57, 58. You can sort of kid yourself, you're sort of this eternal 45, And then when you're in your early 30s, life sort of spreads out before you in these Elysian fields of possibility and hope. But then, one day, you get in your 60s, you can't sort of hide it anymore, and you sort of comb your hair and another big clump comes out in the comb, and you look at the mirror and there's this old geezer looking back at you. Thinking, who the hell's that? And it's closing down. You can count your summers on your fingers if you're lucky. You might just end up having a big heart attack or something at 62, 63, and that's your lot. So, take your chance while you've got it. So, reflect on this precious human rebirth. There's an opportunity. And the other thing, the terrifying thing, volitionally, is if you can't make something of this opportunity, when will you be able to make something of an opportunity? Because if you can't make something of this opportunity, it may not come around again. This might be your one big chance. On the other hand, this might be a low point in a brilliant spiritual career. So take your pick. I think. So just recollect the Buddha, one's teachers, spiritual progress really made. Reflect on the precious opportunity, and just with simple gratitude. And that will, has the effect of gladdening the mind. Just place your attention upon that. And then stage 11 is steadying the mind, I breathe in, steadying the mind, I breathe out. And maybe at this point you can see a pattern emerging. It's like, the Anapanasati is like a spiral that moves up. At each stage it comes around to the same place, but it's slightly higher. So we're just beginning to steady the mind, anchored to the breath, and cultivating, positive mental states. So we're coming around again above stage 4 with body feeling and mind calmed. And here we are absorbed. We begin to be absorbed with mind steadied. And And here we sort of more emphatically and positively begin to develop the dhyana factors, making the mind more subtle, stable and fit for work. So in stage three, we're looking for purity, ethical stability, the mind fit for work. So the way the Anapanasati system is put together is that it's a spiral looking for purity, ethical stability, the mind fit for work, or the mind imbued with positive dhyana factors, with sukha, with joy, happiness, concentration, investigation of mental states, those sorts of things. So, again, in stage 10, we've gladdened the mind. So in stage 11, we're actually, we're staying with the gladdened mind. We've steadied it, but we're moving our concentration more towards the breath at the point of entry to the body. And, through a process of prasrupti, through a process of deepening concentration, we're developing that skillful nature of the mind. So stage 12, we move to liberating the mind. So having steadied the mind, we continue to maintain awareness of the mind. And liberating the mind means ceasing to grasp at body, feeling and mental objects. The mind being the epicenter of grasping attachment. So there are two ways to do this. One is samatha. We temporarily liberate the mind through absorption and dhyana. And two is vipassana. We liberate body, feeling and mind by mindfully observing the flow of mental states rising and falling without arbitrary bias or attachment. So normally what happens is if we go down the samatha path in stage 12, normally how it works is you'll be sitting there, you'll probably be saturated with sukha. You've gladdened the mind, so you're feeling the mind's gladdened and uplifted with a peripheral background of sukha. And you basically can't be fagged going into the vipassana stage. It's like an effort, and you can't. You can't really be fagged. You'd rather just sit there with the sukha, the dhyana factors, and the gladdened mind. So what it's saying in stage 12 is that's fine. That's cool. No worries. Just go with that. Dhyana is very refreshing. It's psychologically, spiritually refreshing, and it's great fun. There's lots of different dhyanas and types of samadhis that you can get into. And it's better than going to the pub, it's like, or switching on the news again, Facebook, looking at some hopeless little screen with wires coming out of your ears. Maybe it's better just to experience peace and joy and happiness, and not be worried about anything, experience an integrated psyche for an hour or two. So this is a definite option at this stage of the practice. But it may be that we're in a state of dhyana, but we do feel like going and looking at vipassana, the more insight range of contemplations. So we can do this, and then we head through into dharma from there. But if in stage 12, we don't want to go with samatha, we can just at the early stages of vipassana, we can just begin to reflect that body, feeling, mind are impermanent. Just start to get a sort of sense of the impermanence of body, feeling, mind. So So liberating the mind means ceasing to grasp at body, feeling and mental objects. The problem of dukkha, according to the Buddha, is grasping. It's not the mental states themselves, they're karmically neutral, it's grasping at them is the problem. So from here on in, we begin to develop an ability to cease to grasp. We begin to work on breaking down our grasping habits. So there's just one point I'd make. It's between samatha concentration and vipassana concentration. And personally, I think this is a bit of a problem in the movement at the moment. The two distinct types of concentration. Samatha is more of a laser-like, one-pointed concentration, focused to a single point. And it constitutes a temporary integration of the psyche and release from the hindrances. So dhyana is something that you enter into or are acted upon by. So dhyana is something that you enter into or are acted upon by. Vipassana encompasses a broad awareness. It's a broad, wide-ranging awareness, particularly of impermanent process arising and ceasing as the play of empty phenomena. And it's here we begin to let go of attachment and aversion as it arises at source. Vipassana proper, insight proper, is a state of being. It's a state of perception that is stable regardless of one's level of dhyana. So, I mean, insight doesn't go away. It's a way of seeing things. If you see something, you don't stop seeing it. I remember when I was living in Melbourne, and I used to walk this route. I must have walked a particular route into town hundreds of times. And I remember one day I was walking along, and I noticed, it must have been after about, I don't know, 100 trips. I noticed this little Victorian garden that I'd never seen before. Because in Melbourne, they've got lots of really lovely Victorian housing. Some of it's sort of, it's not really terraced housing in the sense that you get in England. So you get, and they have like bullnose verandas, with lace work. And they do them really well. The Australians will spare no expense on restoration and, making these beautiful little gardens and things. So I was walking past this particular little place and I saw this garden. And it had been there all the time, but I'd never noticed it. And I noticed it and I was like, wow, what a lovely little garden. And I sort of stopped and had a look at it and then carried on. But thereafter, I noticed it all the time. Oh. So if you see something, you don't stop seeing it. This is the nature of vipassana. The Buddha's, the insight in the Buddha's teaching is seeing directly. It's immediate and visible all around. But vipassana as a meditation form of concentration is this broad awareness of impermanent process, or a broad awareness of body, feeling and mind in relation to impermanence and the rest. So the two distinct types of concentration, that's the point. One is more like focusing to a point, it's more laser-like. The other's a broad awareness. So to get these muddled up results in meditative confusion, basically. You're sort of drifting around in a soup of confused meditative ingredients. Drifting around somewhere between samatha and vipassana, emphasis on concentration. Neither here nor there doesn't really do the job. Mm. And we need to be aware of that. Because otherwise she's got some vague notion of, being aware somehow of consciousness in a particular way or of perception, and you're just actually floating around. Actually, you're distracted half of it. You're just drifting around on the basis of your likes and dislikes. So if you're going to do vipassana, type practice, well, do them. But do them, consciously and clearly. And if you're going to do samatha, do it consciously and clearly. So at this point, we're making a choice. And I think the Anapanasati, you know, emphasizes this. You either go down the route of samatha, you either go with your jhana factors, or you go into the more insight range of experience and contemplation. And Dharma, the Tetrad Dharma, deals specifically with this insight range of contemplation. Although it doesn't exclude samatha. Sometimes samatha will arise from the midst of vipassana type contemplations. But if it does arise, you'll find it's a focused, one-pointed experience of dhyana factors. But the other thing to remember is, again, you know, we're looking at foreground and periphery. Because if you do decide to go into the vipassana type contemplations in the form of the Tetrad of Dharma, you're probably bringing with you, you know, a gladdened mind imbued with sukha. So that becomes the basis for your vipassana type insight. And what you're trying to do is build the mind up. When we talk about this fit for work, we're building the mind up so it's energized, focused. And then you have penetrating awareness. And you have a broad mindfulness. You've built the mindfulness up. It's broad, it's strong, it's substantial, and it can embrace, you know, whatever ever arises. So stage four, liberation. We move either to samatha or vipassana. So again, it's just a progressive system. We're just sensitive to the mind, you know, the ethical status of the mind. We gladden the mind, we steady it, move the breath towards focus at point of entry to the body, and then we move through either to samatha or vipassana.